So my first year of seminary, I was in this introduction to New Testament class. We read the book of Revelation in preparation for a lecture. It was supposed to be a 3-hour lecture on the book of Revelation. And the lecture lasted all of 3 minutes. Professor stood up before us that morning, group of about 150 students. It's Princeton guy. He had the tweed jacket and everything. He'd been teaching longer than I had been alive. And he said, "I don't understand Revelation. And if I don't understand Revelation, neither do you. End of lecture." That was it. So now you can say you have had an entire seminary education on Revelation. Congratulations. There will be no tests. But there are two dominant ways that I think people will come at this book. There are two dominant readings of Revelation. And both of these dominant readings can hurt us. Option one, you treat the book like prophecy. It's like the Da Vinci Code or like National Treasure. There's hidden meaning underneath all of the words here. And if only we can crack the code, we'll understand everything there is to understand. We will know what is coming. We will know who our enemies are. We will know how everything ends. And then suddenly the world becomes something to fear or something to conquer. The world becomes something to withdraw from or something for us to attack. If you subscribe to this reading, then the symbols in this book can be mapped on to modern times, and they can predict the end of the world. They can predict the rapture, never mind the fact that the word rapture never appears in Revelation. Neither does the word Antichrist, for what it's worth. Anyway, this version of Revelation has captured our imaginations, and it has inspired some wonderful horror movies, a lot of books, TV shows, Bible studies. It's been used to organize cults. It's been used to justify war. It's been used for all sorts of things. You've heard this framework. Maybe you believe in this framework. Maybe you've been burned by this framework. Maybe you roll your eyes at it and you say to yourself what one congregant told me when I first mentioned we were doing a series on Revelation. She said, "Revelation, that's where all the kooks hang out." That's where we're hanging out, too, for the next 8 weeks. And so then instead you subscribe to the second way of reading this book, which is the way of the professor. I don't get it, so let's just pretend it doesn't exist. And this is where I've lived for a long time. And I'm guessing it's where most of us in this room are as well, maybe not all of us. You don't quite buy the fear, but without something to really hold on to, you settle for something else. And it becomes a quieter kind of loss. Faith that avoids hard questions, that sees symbols, and instead of meeting that with curiosity and wonder, runs the other way. When we refuse to grapple with what we don't understand, we miss out on an opportunity to grow. Friends, again, today marks week one of this 8-week series on Revelation, and my hope is that over the next 8 weeks, we can together discover a third way of reading this book. Not a way of fear, not a way of avoidance, but a way of seeing differently, of letting this book capture our imagination, letting it disturb us, letting it confuse us, letting it challenge us, and letting it speak to us today. Because Revelation is not trying to predict the future. It is trying to show us the present and to help us imagine a better way for our world. Revelation is going to get really, really weird. If you thought that today's second scripture reading was weird, just wait. Revelation's going to get bizarre. And so it helps us then for this first week to anchor ourselves in something human. And here in this first chapter, we are reminded that Revelation is a letter written by a man. That's it. Revelation is just a letter. It's written by just a guy. And these things matter. They help us orient ourselves. This book has an author. It has a context. It has an audience. And it has a form. The form is an epistle. It's a letter. The audience are these seven churches, this group of emerging faith communities. And the author, John, maybe he was a pastor, maybe he wasn't a pastor, maybe he planted these churches. We don't quite know. We do know that this John is not the same John as our Gospels. Our John is referred to as John of Patmos. And Patmos is where we get our context. See, Patmos wasn't quite a prison, but it was close. Patmos was an island, and the Roman Empire would send dissidents away to this island of Patmos whenever execution was deemed maybe too excessive or just too risky. Rome did not want another Jesus situation on their hands where you execute someone only for the movement to grow. And so they preferred instead to kill the movement. And so people like John then would be sent into exile, John of Patmos. And this early Christian movement denied Caesar as a king, and it was viewed then as a threat to the Roman Empire. It threatened to upend this political order and to disturb the peace that was very carefully achieved through brute force and violence. And so it wasn't enough to kill John. The empire sought to drain the hope out of him and to show those Christians what true power looked like. Power meant might. Might meant fear. And empires always rule with a healthy dose of both. There's a concept in architecture, some of you have probably heard of, it's called the panopticon, and it's this design for a prison where the cells are arranged in a massive circle, and at the very center of this circle, there sits a watchtower, and the prisoners cannot see inside the watchtower. They never know if a guard is actually there watching, and so eventually, they just assume that they're always being watched as they all watch one another. And so what happens is they eventually start to police themselves. They stop talking. They stop dreaming. And they become their own jailers. It's been argued that Facebook operates kind of like a panopticon, the social pressure of folks watching you. You know, you don't always post on Facebook every thought. If you do post on Facebook every thought, maybe think about that. But Facebook, it's been said, has operated like a panopticon. Rome was a panopticon. Rome had their flock cameras. Rome was like Big Brother. They were always watching, limiting what you do, limiting what you feel, limiting how you think. This is one of the primary ways that empire operates. It wants to crush our imagination. It wants to silence us and our ability to dream. Fall in line or get out of line. If you don't like it, there's the door. Leave the country. Go to Patmos. Times like these, it is very tempting to just run away, to dissociate, to disengage. Do we stay in this place? Do we try and piece together a very broken system? Or do we just leave? Do we withdraw? Let it be somebody else's problem. Things aren't really that bad, right? There's a Star Wars series called Andor. tells this street-level story of an empire and an emerging resistance. And the show Andor, it's a prequel. It's set BS, that's before Skywalker. And in Andor, there's a panopticon. There's a literal panopticon in the show. It's this prison that has no bars and no locks. And the way the prison works is the floors are electrified. And the guards sit in this center tower, always unseen. And the prisoners work in silence. They start to police one another because they never know when this electrical floor might hum to life and kill one of them. And over time, they slowly lose their humanity. They lose their names. They become referred to just by their prison ID, their numbers. They lose their ability to envision anything outside of this place. They lose their ability to envision a better life. And then this young revolutionary sees through it and he pins this manifesto. It's this message for anyone who will listen, anyone out there, kind of like this book of Revelation. In it, he writes, "The imperial need for control is so desperate because it is so unnatural. Tyranny requires constant effort. It breaks, it leaks. Authority is brittle. And the day will come when all these skirmishes and battles will be one too many." He reminds his people that this too will end. And in doing so, he exposes the empire. He exposes it not as mighty, but as brittle, as fearful. This police state as a performance, as a stage play designed to make you feel small. And then once you see the leaks, once you realize that the tower is built up on a lie, the threat loses some of its power. You can still get hurt. The risk is very much still there. But suddenly you can dream again. You can dream. And so he dares his community to imagine a better world. This is exactly what John is doing from his island. He is writing to a community that is living in the shadow of a Roman watchtower, to these emerging churches in a moment of deep existential crisis. To this community that is living in terror, afraid to worship, afraid to pray, afraid to act. Their hope is bleeding out. Their imagination is running dry. They know only fear. And here's John in Revelation chapter 1 saying to those churches, "Hey friends, it's me. I'm still in Patmos. I'm still being watched. Rome is still in power. But Rome is still not king." Here's John in this introduction saying, "I cannot tell you everything that I want to tell you. I can't say it in plain Greek. So I'm going to need you to use that imagination of yours. Don't let those muscles atrophy. I'm going to use some coded language here just to get this letter through. Here's some coded language to get you started. I'm going to tell you how to interpret it, how to interpret these stars and these lampstands. They're the churches. Okay, you got that? Good. For you to understand me and the rest of my letter, you're going to need to dream with me. Because in these times we live in, resistance requires imagination. So I'm going to ask you, friends, to imagine with me," John says. "Imagine a better way. Imagine a better world." John's call to these seven churches is God's call for us today. Do not let fear stamp out your imagination. Resist with integrity. Resist with ingenuity. Resist with hope. This is the third way of reading Revelation. Not fearful end times plotting, but also not avoidance where we just ignore the hard stuff and forget to dream. This third way of reading Revelation is the way of civil resistance. It's of a faith that cannot be silenced and an imagination that cannot be contained. This third way recognizes that none of us are on an island. We are all in this together. This third way hears the manifesto of a lonely prisoner on Patmos and proclaims that authority is indeed brittle, that false kings topple, and that the light of God is already poking through. So friends, as we begin this journey, let your imaginations roam free. Don't worry about understanding everything. Just imagine and resist. Resist what needs resisting. And dream better dreams. Because the empire is trembling, the tower is crumbling, and John has a vision for us all. It's a vision of a better way. And it's a vision of a better world. Amen.